Hello, everyone, and welcome to the riotous return of Turned Out a Punk Footnotes. I am one of your hosts, Damien Abraham, and your other host, as always, is my friend and your friend, Chris O'Toole. Chris, how are you doing?
Great. How are you doing?
Good. It feels like I haven't said that in like months.
Yeah, I don't know about months, but yeah, thereabouts.
Well, and another thing I haven't said definitely in months is welcome back to the show, David Up. Dave, fresh off the plane from Thailand. Here you are. Appreciate you making it here for what I'm going to label a holiday spectacular.
Oh, my pleasure to be here. I am coming off of a 13-hour time difference, but we'll see. You know, I'll stay as focused as I can.
Well, that it's great because like that way, no matter when the listener's listening to it, they're going to have someone on their level.
Yeah.
You know, unless they're drunk, because none of us are drunk, you know, or high on cocaine. None of us are high on cocaine, but they'll have like, you know, if they're up early or up late, they'll have someone on their level. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you for coming on the show and or Chris being on your own show. And Dave, this is a great opportunity for us to reconvene. You know, we were talking off air. We had some of the forbidden from broadcast topics discussed off air, and now we are ready to discuss things that are fit for everyone's consumption.
I almost wanted to see, since we had a behind the scenes, we had a text conversation earlier in the day that. I almost wish we had just done it then so that I could maintain my appearing on this podcast from Mexico and then appearing on this podcast in Shanghai.
Yeah.
I think would be a real good phone in, but I was, you know, at the Shanghai airport, it's probably not super conducive to talking on the phone.
No, this podcast has been very international, I can say. Like, more international than just about any other podcast that I can think of. But mind you, as I also told you guys off air, I only listen to wrestling podcasts, so maybe just my wrestling podcasts aren't that international.
Yeah.
Actually,
I'm sure sure that's not true.
Well, no, that's not true. I listen to Burning Spirits. Do you know this podcast, Burning Spirits?
No.
I've never heard it. No. Is it like what I think it would be?
It's a pro wrestling podcast, but done by hardcore kids. So that's why they named it Burning Spirits. And they talk about where the name came from in the first episode. And it's, so it's a much beloved podcast by myself, because not only is it people talking about wrestling that I love, and these guys are way deeper heads than I am, you know, like, so it's like I get to learn, but also at the same time, I know it's hardcore guys. One of the dudes from Dry Rot's in it, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
There's a true crime podcast that I listen to, called My Favorite Murder, and I've seen photos of the one woman's husband that does it, and he's wearing a Uniform Choice shirt.
Whoa.
In photos, as far as just like being a super nerd to like go to someone whose podcast you listen to's partner. But yeah, I'm like, oh, that dude's in hardcore, I guess.
Well, I forgot to tell you guys off air about some of the upcoming guests that are coming on, but there, yeah, definitely some surprise ones coming on too. There's a lot of people out there that are still I didn't know about that come from, you know, punk and hardcore, you know, and like a lot of people, you know, that I'm finding out about, you know, doing cool things that are adjacent to this world. Cool. Or in this world and stuff too. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing good. Can't really complain. Hating winter. Other than that, everything is lovely.
Awesome. Well, I guess like since we last spoke, I wrapped up shooting the TV show. So that is done. Chris, you have a new job.
Yes, so always it seems to be the story.
Yeah, well, we won't go into any of the details about a new job or anything, it sounds, you know, as we were saying off air, like a step up and an improvement. And it also means that maybe we'll be able to come back with some regularity in the near future.
Well, I think part of the disconnect for listeners is that, and that we've expressed this numerous times, and again, I apologize, but it's both Damien and I's life has been in pretty major upheaval over the last, at least 2 or 3 months. So in particular, if not the whole year. So that's why it's been hard to kind of link up to do a regular weekly thing. But yeah, I certainly intend to be back on that as long as you are not in foreign places at all times.
Yeah, no, that exactly. Like, go figure, two guys that were sitting around with nothing to do could come up with time to do a podcast every week without fail. Yeah. But yeah, no, as soon as our lives got a little bit busy, it became a lot more difficult. So now that we're back with somewhat stability and regularity for at least the foreseeable future, we will be back on track, you know, and the mailbag will be kicking alive again, and we will be ready to devour that.
Yes, for sure.
But
you guys haven't done mailbag in so long that I question how much is even in it at this point.
Like, well, we have a few stragglers, and we're not forgetting them, but they are there. And I think what it is that, much like to what you're saying, like, yeah, because it hasn't been addressed, we're not receiving as much. That is true. But but there's been some funny little ones that have come through over the last little bit. But yeah, I feel like if it becomes active again, that's when we'll start to see the increase.
Yeah, and well, so where do they send those emails, Chris?
Yeah, it's turnedoutapunkfootnotes@gmail.com.
We did get in some cool stuff on the other email address, too, over at the other Turned Out a Punk podcast, and including a Fearless form rejection letter that Fearless Records sent out.
They had a form rejection letter, too?
Yeah. That's the thing that's cool about this podcast, is there's people that are constantly finding out about it, right? So there's people that are constantly like going through and listening to old episodes and like sharing new tidbits. So someone who had been listening to the Fat Mike Aaron podcast was like, oh, I don't like, and never, I guess, listened to the footnotes where we eventually did get an original, or at least a copy of an original Fat Records rejection letter. And then we did find out from Fat Records, a source at Fat Records, the label, that there is such a thing as a real rejection letter, and they do have a supply, and he was supposed to actually give me one for Fucked Up, but you know, I think Fat Mike silenced him, or Aaron silenced him, when they found out that he was going to get that letter and put it out there in the world, because he never sent it.
I don't know why anyone want, like, why would, like, I don't know, the perception that you'd want to hide that, or think it's, I don't know, like, it's you're you know, you have by all rights as a record label, you can reject whatever you want, you know, what's it matter?
Yeah,
is it because it's not personal?
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's also because it makes you look a little, you know, shitty.
I guess.
But, you know, maybe that's what they're worried about, is that, like, they would look shitty to some people.
I suppose, but, I mean, that wouldn't that be your first thought before you ever made that?
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, but, like, let's be honest. Like, in the 90s, it was cool to be shitty. Like, it was like, you know, like, there were cults around people because they were super, super shitty. Like, Charles Manson was, like, kind of cool, and he's, like, one of the shittiest dudes potentially ever. And you know, so, like, the 90s, like, it was, like, a very different time than now, right? Like, so, you know, I'm not saying that it's on, like, you know, making tribute movies to Charles Manson level of shitty, but, you know, like, sending out rejection letters is kind of shitty.
Yeah, I think it's fairly innocuous personally, but what I find more intriguing about what was just mentioned is that Fat Records at least makes a decent amount of sense that would happen, because I could see them being particularly burdened in that window of time by a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, groups yeah. bothering them. Fearless, though, you know, all due respect, how they have a form rejection letter, like, that seems kind of... Did they all have them?
Oh, no, but they have at the drive-in, they had, like, huge bands.
I bet the bands that were mailing in demos to any of those labels mailed them to all of those labels.
Yeah.
So, that's a good point. You know, I'm sure, like, I mean, as much as it could seem, like, faceless and impersonal, I bet you the sheer volume of demos that Fat Records would receive, like, in a month would be staggering at points, you know, maybe late 90s, early 2000s, you know, like the height of the Warped Tour era. I'm sure they were just getting inundated with crap they didn't want.
Oh, yeah.
And there's only so many things you want to write back to.
Yeah, like those bands, like, I remember trying to interview Fat Mike for my zine, at the Warped Tour, and it was like, you know, it was like trying to get a rock star. Like, they were like huge rock stars. They were on like Billboard charts for selling like legit numbers of records. Like, it's amazing. Yeah. It's staggering how many records those bands sold back then.
Yeah, true. Well, that's sustained the model, though. Like, the thing that's crazy about it is, what I guess I was trying to communicate earlier is that what we've just unearthed about the idea of, like, the need for a form letter. Like, anyone who's, like, or at least for a window of time previously, or even, I guess, to a degree still now, like, has read an interview or seen an interview with Mike or just kind of the whole Fat Records thing, like, they were snarky. Like, that was the thing. That was part of it.
Yeah.
So to receive, like, a snarky rejection letter doesn't even really seem dickish because it seems completely in character.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but I think that now it's like, you know, they're trying to change the narrative a little bit.
Perhaps, yeah. It's just, I don't know. Like, it's, I get it, but I just think it's kind of funny that there's this, like, bizarre need. I think the aspect of, like, I don't want to accuse anyone of trying to cover it up, but just the idea of even bothering with that seems like that action in and of itself is more than necessary, like, more than is needed, because it makes it seem sketchier than it is or something, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, that's the thing is, like, I don't know why they denied it. Like, you know, I could see them being like, yeah, don't send him, or, like, you know, him not sending me that letter. But it's the fact that they denied it in the podcast. It's like, no, like, we know it exists. Like, we've seen it. Like, you know, it's like, you don't have to deny it, unless it was, like, someone in the office that did it without them knowing.
Yeah, which I guess could be a
happen.
Thing.
Definitely could happen. You know?
Yeah, if you're the guy who has to respond to all those, you're probably like, let me just copy and paste this.
Yeah, like, having worked at a record label, it's amazing the stuff you could have gotten away with as far as, like, you know, portraying yourself as the artist in, like, you know, like, being like, oh, yeah, like, let's sign this deal. Let's do this, you know? Like, as a record label, you have a lot of power over the bands that you're, you know, putting out the records of.
Yeah.
So, anyway. We are talking about stuff. Do we have any mailbag stuff that we need to get to?
There's little ones. Like, there's a funny one, but I kind of feel like that we should maybe address it on, like, a centric episode where we try to tackle old ones and then incite, you know, the solicit for new ones or something. That way it's all in one theme. But if you want to keep, like, if you want to hit on, there's definitely one I think is very amusing that I want to bring up. But
let's do it.
Doesn't matter if we do it now. All right.
Let's do it now.
So the one in particular, I got to just look real quick because I didn't think we were going to get into it. Just be a minute.
No problem.
So the subject line is, I just want to see if I can get the sender here. Dan from the United Kingdom, and the subject line is, Damien owes Chris a ticket to see The Who. And you can see where I'm going with this already. The body is, hi guys, just plowing through the back catalog again, and in episode 71, Damien said he would buy Chris a ticket to see The Who if Turn of the Punk got a sponsor. Just want to thank you so much for making
that's true.
For making painting and decorating more bearable. Listening to podcasts pretty much every day. Also, thanks for reinforcing my commitment to making my 3-year-old listen to Husker Du, or Husker Du, however you want that pronounced. Please keep up the great work. And there you go.
Okay, that's, well, Chris, that is very true. I had forgotten about that promise. The next time The Who come through, I'm buying a ticket for you.
I will gladly accept, but I didn't want to read it as a true, I'm going to hold you to that.
No,
I just thought it was really funny.
We do have a sponsor now.
Well, I just thought it was absolutely hilarious that someone pulled, of all the things from this show, the tidbits that have existed, that was one that came back. So, yes, thank you, Dan. Great message. And I guess I'll be seeing The Who, maybe.
Yes, you will. They are amazing. And, like, that is one of the best shows that I have seen in a long time.
But that, to bring it to this podcast, like, listening to, like, Vic Bondi made me feel like, you know, I should see some of those, like, old time, like, you know, older generation rock bands, like, while you still can.
Yeah.
Like, I should just see the Rolling Stones or see The Who just to, like, check that off and, you know, just to do it.
Well, yeah, like it's, you know, a friend of the show, Jeff Johns, like that's what he does all the time now is he goes to just see classic rock bands. He's like, these shows are the best shows to go to. So there's no pretension. You just go to the show. You know, the band rocks out for like the given time. You know, all the songs, they play all the hits. You know?
Yeah, like, have you seen Alice Cooper?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw Alice Cooper, and it was awesome. There was no opening act. He played for, like, maybe 2 hours, like, all bangers, and then it was, and I was, like, you know, 9:30 walking to my car. I'm like, perfect.
Did he do that thing with his daughter where she was doing, like, Kill Bill?
I don't know. There was no daughter present.
Okay, his daughter was, like, I think it was his daughter. At least that's what I remember someone telling me at the time. And she was doing, like, a Kill Bill kind of fight sequence with him at one point. Like, we're in the...
Yeah, that did not happen for mine.
Okay, because that did make that show drag a little bit for me, I have to admit. I'm like, there's got to be a song that could have fit in here instead. I saw that. I saw Meatloaf one time live. That was all right.
Yeah, I haven't. I'm trying to think of groups like that that I've seen. I saw Kiss. They were great, but that was probably 17, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
See, my apprehension on any of this, like we discussed in the initial episode of which that was referenced in that email, is I'm just, you know, I just don't know the state of what a lot of these people are in. So it's the investment in gambling on that.
When you went,
what's that?
Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, like when you went and saw Kiss 17 or 18 years ago, they're probably, yeah, aren't they the same age that Coxbar would be now when you go and see Coxbar? Like, it's kind of like, maybe. That is like, it's weird to think, but like, if I were to go, like when Lauren and I went to see that Rain and Maria show a couple of weeks ago, I'm like, this is like what classic rock is now. Like what classic rock to us was. Like my kids would be like, oh, my parents went and saw this band. Like in the same way that I was like, oh, my parents went and saw the Eagles or something.
Yeah. The only thing I would say to that is, would I go see Kiss now? No. Would I have gone to see Cox Bar 17, 18 years ago? Yes. Would I go see, and I did see them, whatever, a year ago.
Yeah.
I would still. So that, yeah, it's relative, but it's just, that's my always my concern. Although I have no question, I believe you with The Who. I love The Who, so I would be more than happy. But there are some groups where I just, you're looking at, like Guns N' Roses, I've never seen. I had the opportunity a couple times, and it's like, yeah, I don't know about that one. Or, you know, like Motley Crue or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. Like, I've had plenty of opportunities, and I tend to shy away from it. But, yeah, I'm feeling the idea of maybe now dropping a bit of that to at least catch some of it, to at least see it. Like Alice Cooper, I would genuinely like to see, and I wouldn't shy away from that. So I'm with Big Time with you.
I saw Metallica for the first time and only time this summer. Yeah. And I was like, a band I've liked since like the 80s and never saw, and just was like, you know what? It was cool. I mean, it wasn't at the same time, but, you know, I'm glad that I went, you know, like there's obviously it was, you know, I would have picked a slightly different set list, but like, you know, it was cool to see it. Like the songs that you like, you still can get like pumped on seeing them live.
When you say slightly different set list, I assume you mean like just the
entirely
whole
different
load record, right?
yeah. They didn't play anything off the S&M record. I would have changed it significantly, but, you know, still cool to see them.
I think that Memory Remains song is pretty sick. Off Reload?
I don't know.
Even know a song off that is like,
is that what it's called, I think? It's like, that's a hot take.
I have no idea.
I lose them post, like, a cool guy answer, but, like, I don't even fuck with the Black Album. Like,
Oh, that's not a cool guy answer around here. That's like the common rank and file opinion, unfortunately, on this podcast.
No, but I feel like the cool guy answer should be like, oh, I don't do anything after Master of Puppets. You know, like, I'll at least acknowledge Justice for All.
Yeah. No, that's true. I know what you're saying there, Dave. I'm with you.
I find it, like, most, unless you're like a super old head, and then like, but I think most people will give Injustice for All to them too.
Yeah.
A lot of people dislike that record. I think that's kind of foolish. I mean, there's stuff on it that doesn't age well, particularly the drums. But there's some, like, song-wise, there's some great songs on that record. But
the issue is the length. Is that every song is long as fuck. And, yeah, like, that's what takes you out of it. But they do reference Discharge in it, so, like, you know, that's cool.
Yeah, there's some deadly stuff on that record. Like, Dyer's Eve is deadly.
Yeah.
Still, like, I'm a big fan of that record. I wish the drums were better, but, yeah. Anyway, this is funny that we're going so deep on Metallica right now, but, yeah.
Well, you know, that's the point, right? Hey, I tried to reference a recent episode.
No, you did good. I just laughing that debate. Like, I've already had a Metallica Black Album rant once on the show. I'm not going to do it again.
Yeah, Chris has definitely got heated about that record. Heated.
Yeah. Well, you don't want me to open the door about being like, well, you know, here's what it like when I saw Kiss, or here's Motley Crue when I saw them, because, like, that's also, like, really in the weeds of this podcast.
Well, no, that's good. Do you genuinely like any of that stuff? Like, do you like old Kiss? Do you like?
Oh yeah.
Whatever? Yeah. Okay.
I saw Kiss in '90, so I saw Kiss.
Yeah.
Before they put the makeup back on, like, yeah, I saw them on the Hot in the Shade tour. Like, I saw them at, like, the darkest era of seeing Kiss. Like, just like Go super thieves. Bullshit. Like, I mean, their set list is fine, but, like, you're getting some a lot more '80s Kiss than you did, like, in 96 or whatever, when they, like, came back with the makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah, this podcast has aged, like, 30 years in its hiatus. Like, we used to talk about NoFX and Descendants, and now we're talking about Kiss and Motley Crue. Go on, though. I'm just...
Yeah.
I just noticed.
I did not see Motley Crue, like, then. I saw Motley Crue in, like, 2004. Four, maybe, I don't know, like, with the four real dudes. And it was the first concert that I went to that I didn't get, like, just straight nosebleed, like, far as fuck seats for.
Yeah.
And it was actually very fun to see it, like, in, like, the, you know, 12th row or whatever the hell we were. Like, we were relatively close, and it was
nice.
It actually was a lot more fun.
So the question is, on this one, Damien, being that you are not, you don't come from that aspect of this as much, do you like either of those groups?
Like Kiss?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Kiss. Like, I like Kiss songs, I should say. Yeah. No, Motley Crue, I've never gotten into it at all. And it's
fair enough.
I like, you know, and I like that first record. I can see why people like it, and I can see how that connects to stuff I like. I think Hanoi Rocks is probably, and Guns N' Roses are, like, as close to that as I go. But it was never, like, I don't know, like, at the time, even, like, I had Poison open up and say, ah. And, I remember just being like, yeah, Every Rose Has Its Thorn is okay. But, like, none of the other songs really spoke to me.
No. The first album, Look What the Cat Dragged In, pretty much hits the whole way through. Like no one's, like, throwing on Play Dirty, but, like, you know, it's fine. No, I saw Poison on the Flesh and Blood tour, which is really, like, not what you need to see.
Yeah, because you were a total glam metal dude.
Yeah, yeah. So, like,
that's, I guess,
I can't buy Poison. I'm not with you there. You lose me here, both of you.
I like not Aerosmith Pump, too. That was, like, another
record. Oh, good Lord.
I was having, like, an 80s and 90s Aerosmith conversation with some people really recently, and it's just like it's just like a dark door to, like, because in the way that you consume music in 2017, you could be like, hey, maybe I'll just throw Permanent Vacation on, and you know, you're not spending any money, it's super simple, but then you're like, what am I doing? Like, you might want to just hear Ragdoll, but then, like, then if you keep going with it, you're like, you don't need to hear this shit. Like, you don't need to hear, like, My Heart's Done Time or you know, any of that shit. It's just, you don't need it. Like, I don't fuck with that at all.
I respect it, because, like, that's a group where, like, that's a guy who had a voice and just, like, fucked it. He, like, fucked his voice so bad. But then he, like, had a second life. It's almost like a shitty butterfly. You know? Like, It's like a beautiful.
Isn't that a Sonic Youth song?
We gotta make Turnetta Punk t-shirts and Shitty Butterfly. Isn't that a Sonic Youth song? Should be in the Sonic Youth font. Shitty Butterfly. Yeah.
I can't wait for Steven Tyler's episode when you reference this of calling him like a shitty butterfly.
No, but yeah, I mean, like, I respect the fact that he had like a second life with a voice that he had unfortunately, you know, destroyed through, you know, from what has been told, excess. Like, I always wonder what happened because, like, you hear him on those early records, it's like a different dude on those 90s records.
Well, I think it's one of those things where it might just be like a Brian Johnson situation where you could have your, like, let me put my love into you, like, kind of regular voice, but then you have your, like, Back in Black voice, and then people are like, no, let's just use that one all the time. And then you're just like, that's the like, you know, it's like being typecast. Like, I feel like he just got stuck doing, like, the high voice.
But I don't think I don't think he can do Dream On like that now. You know, like,
I mean, did you ever promise to buy tickets to see Aerosmith for Chris?
No, I did see Aerosmith though on, but it was like Get a Grip tour, unfortunately, not Pump tour.
Oh, good lord!
Did they have anyone funny opening? Like, was it like,
yeah, it was
Soundgarden or?
No, even better, Four Non Blondes.
Oh, cool.
Whoa!
With what? I can't remember what's her name?
Was the rest of their set?
What?
Besides their one hit?
Well, yeah, they definitely they played that hit. And I said, hey, yeah. I remember, like, I got a real intense flashback when I started doing that to that show.
Yeah. What's going on? Yeah.
But she's like become like one of the most successful songwriters of, our generation.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. She's a modern age, Desmond Child.
Like, yeah, she's probably written more hits than Perry and Tyler.
The Four Non Blondes woman?
Yeah.
Cause what else? She did all the Pink stuff.
She did some Pink stuff. She did also,
I think she did like a lot of it. Yeah.
Ashley Simpson's, successful song. She did
when's she going to be on?
I don't know. I like, yo, it turns out she was like, and that's when I heard Crossed Out for the first time. When in an upcoming episode, a person from a very singer-songwriter-y kind of world starts talking about a collaborative project they had with Cavity, that's why I love doing this podcast. That's what, because it's just like, there's these moments. So if she comes on and like drops some knowledge, oh my gosh. I don't even know where they were from, Four Non Blondes. But anyway, Aerosmith was pretty sick that night. It was a good show. I saw AC/DC on the Razor's Edge tour, and it was Jackal opening, I think.
Oh
boy.
Probably my favorite
chainsaw
band.
Yeah, he used the chainsaw on stage.
Yeah. Oh man.
AC/DC were fucking incredible. That night, they were really awesome.
I never saw them, sadly.
No, me either. Regret but now, of course, but yeah.
That I blame that though on punk ruining my ability to like watch bands play long sets. Like,
yeah,
I just don't want to watch a band play for 3 hours, and I don't want, like, I know that you're like paying $50, so it sucks if they play for 25 minutes, but like, I just don't want to do it. So it's like, I don't know.
I'm with you 100%. Like, I don't know why people insist. Like, when you're playing a band and you hit that point where people start being like, oh, actually, you're contractually obligated to play for an hour. You know, like, it's like, why? Like, why? Like, I still don't. I've never seen a band play where I've been like, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't 15 minutes of the set that was perfect. And then, like, other parts that drag. Like it's like, if every band just played for 15 minutes, you'd always want more. Or 30 minutes. Let's not be ridiculous. 30 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, AC/DC, that's why they're amazing, because they bring up props, you know? Hell's Bells, there's a bell on stage that's ringing, you know? There's for those about to rock, we salute you. There's a cannon. They're firing a cannon. You know, it's a show. It was a show as a kid, as an 8-year-old. That was a lights, camera, action show. It's crazy to think that I went to an AC/DC show at 8 years old And well, actually, I brought my kid to a Neurosis show, so I was going to be like pretend to be all high and mighty about how I'd never let my kid do something like that. But I totally brought my son to a Neurosis, a Melvin show. So maybe I'm the worst parent. But no, the Melvin show's way less sketchy than an AC/DC show was in '88.
I mean, AC/DC were pretty darn established by '88. I assume it wasn't like, you know,
no,
like it was in some sketch. It was a concert.
Yeah, it was in the Sky Dome, which is like, you know, at the time the biggest venue in Toronto. But like, I definitely like there, like, you know, there was a sink full of puke in the bathroom, just like a full to the brim sink of puke that I remember seeing, and like a guy having sex with a girl in like a hall, and like, you know, you smelt weed. Like, it was just like, you know, very different than the experience of going to this Melvins concert, which backstage, like, you know, like Holden was, you know, talking to Barney from Napalm Death. You know, it was a very civilized backstage. There was no cannabis, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to protect your kids from cannabis, I think you probably have your work cut out for you.
But. Well, you know, I'm just trying to, like, do what my parents did to me with cigarettes and alcohol, where it just exposed me to so much of it as a young person because they were doing it, that I now I'm just like, oh, never. You know, so let's be my kids with cannabis. Yeah. Not that I do it in front of them, but I mean, like, you know, just daddy's, you know, when the guy at the convenience store comes up to talk to me about weed, they know what daddy does for a living.
The one point I wanted to acknowledge, because I think it's very well stated, and you sort of touched on it as well, Dave, was that Dave bringing up the, you know, the punk ruin long sets for me thing. I think it's even further for me. I feel it's also this idea of like, there's at least from like my age forward, so I would say like 90s centric up punk hardcore related things, where there was almost like, or I felt at a time, there was almost like a guilt to like any showmanship to a performance, truly, because in like pop punk terms you started to get like real cornball things. Mm-hmm. And that just seems super lame. And so although you did have like always your John Spencers and your Rocket from the Crypts, but I remember, like, the first time I saw Rocket from the Crypt, I remember being, like, not really down with the idea of the shtick of what they did, like, as far as, like, the way they looked.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I blame that on exactly kind of what you were talking about, Dave, like, that idea of, like, you know, everything needs to be, like, morose, you know, like, really super bland political, you know, diatribes or something. In that era, not to say there's anything wrong with either of those things, but... I feel like that there was a that was the temperature of the moment in a lot of cases, and it ruined anything that wasn't kind of in that realm for me. And now included with that would be like a proper concert, quote unquote, by some of, like, you know, if not these bands, we're talking about something else. Like this year, I've kind of gone to see a bit more like proper concerts on a regular basis. One, because I'm a boring old person now. And also because it's stuff that I know I've ignored, and I'm worried that I'm going to get to that point, like, not so much with the classic rock stuff, but, like, you know, I'd never seen Belle and Sebastian or something. So I went and did that. And it was just like, yeah, this is nothing like what I normally do. But it's great in its own, you know, in its own way. So I'm with you 100% on that idea that... you do get ruined in a weird way, and it's sometimes it's for the better because you ignore some junk. Uh-huh. But I do think it can be detrimental as well because you ignore some great stuff just because it's, you know, even just for me, like the price of a concert, you know, is and was kind of a point of contention. Like, not that I don't expect people to charge money, obviously, but like, you know, when a concert's like above a certain price, I'm always like, well, do I really care that much? I've seen like hundreds of concerts, if not thousands or 8,000. So why do I need to see another artist anyway? And why do I need to overpay for that kind of thing? You know what I mean?
It becomes like such a weird double-edged sword where you have to accept that like there's a degree that people want to like make a living off of it. But it just becomes like, it's like, am I paying $12 to see like a show that's like pretty much everyone's local? Then you're like, well, what's the point? Like, you know, like this could just be a benefit show. If it's one thing if you're helping like a touring band out.
Yeah.
But then you have to say like, do I need to hold non-punk artists? Like, I don't need to hold Iron Maiden to like punk ethos because they're not, you know? So then it, you know, I mean, I'll spend some money on a concert, but once again, like, I'm not trying to like go to concerts every week. Like, I, you know, if I spent $70 to see Metallica, it's one thing, but I wouldn't want to pay like $70 to see like the Impalers.
I get what you mean.
Yeah. No offense.
Having said that, great
LP.
Great band.
Yeah. Everything. My favorite local band.
I push back on that. The only reason why I wouldn't pay it now is because I've already seen them and I, you know, I'm good. But they're worth $70. I'll say that much.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they were a funny band to pick on. But, like, I mean, that said, like, I've flown and seen bands. So it's like, ultimately, you know, like, I have, I mean, I've spent real money to see, contemporary-ish bands, just because if you factor in a plane ticket, then, you know, you're spending concert money on a show.
This year I saw two of the best concerts I saw in my entire life, and I paid full price for them. They weren't both expensive, but one was like that PJ Harvey show I went to was pretty expensive. And it was fucking,
I love that you love it so much. So
you just shut your eyes and you're like, is this the Foreskins?
No, yeah, it was heavy, that song. When they played it live, I was like, fuck. The only thing that was annoying is, like, the thing that sucks about concerts is other people. Like, I would pay that much money if I could watch that show in isolation, but, like, hearing people, like, yell out songs they want to hear, and it's funny that I say this, someone who, like, lives and dies by interaction with audience when I play live, but, like, to be in the crowd, I'm like, oh, God, like we love you, PJ! Like, oh, shut up! Just like, she knows you bought a ticket, it's sold out, you know, like,
and then, yeah, she probably had a set list.
She had a set list. It was killer. She had a set list. She played the whole record. It was awesome. There was like a little bit of a stage show, but not so much where you're like, oh, this is like really shticky. Yeah, it was really good. And then the other one's Gauze, which was not expensive. Gauze? And that was like the opposite show of that. And it was fucking the best show I ever saw.
I thought those Burning Spirits-y kind of shows were expensive.
The Gauze show was the equivalent of $5.
Oh, really?
And that included a drink.
I thought a lot of those kind of shows were like $30.
No,
like, it was not like going to break the bank, but like not $5 either.
I can't remember what the Death Side show was. It wasn't that expensive, but it was definitely more expensive. But it was, no, the Gauze show was like super cheap. Gauze played first, you know, before Life. So unfortunately kind of killed the room, and the room was packed. It sold out, you know, they had tickets saved for foreigners at the door. And you could buy your ticket and go in, and it was, it was like the best concert I've ever been to. It was fucking incredible. Played for an hour, no stops.
See, that's funny because you said earlier about the length, and so that was one that didn't bother you lengthwise?
Yeah, it didn't bother me. Didn't bother me at all. Like, it didn't feel like an hour, actually, at all. I feel really fortunate that I've gotten to see stuff that I really enjoyed, be it wrestling or be it music. And it's amazing how if you're seeing something you really enjoy, time is irrelevant.
I agree.
Yeah.
Like this podcast, when it comes in at 6 hours, people are going to be like, well, I really enjoyed it, so it was irrelevant that it took 6 hours.
Yeah, they answered that one email. You know, it was a really good one.
Well done, man. Well done.
They talked about Kiss for the first 20 minutes of the show.
I mean, I can keep going if you want.
Point of reference, speaking of nerdiness, well, I believe now that I think about that, asking you that question about Kiss, Dave, do you not have on one of your records Alito. Is it a hidden song or something where you actually do cover
we covered
Deuce or not Deuce, it was Strutter maybe?
Yeah, we covered Deuce.
So, that song's great.
And we also, to just keep it on point, we almost covered Dirty Deeds on Nothing to Nothing and then changed it like the week before we recorded to that Rose Tattoo cover.
Nice.
Whoa.
Like, we were very close to doing AC/DC, and then we've been playing it. Like, we played it at Chicago Fest, and then we're like, I'm bored of this song. Like, let's just do something else. Like, you know that thing where you essentially, like, write material, and then by the time you actually get around to recording it, you're like, we have new songs now. I don't, you know, these aren't exciting anymore. Like, that cover, we'd kind of, like, run its course, so we didn't record it.
I've never been in a band that, like, played out live with material before recording it that much.
You must have been early fucked up.
Yeah, but like
by default.
Yeah, but like those, but that's like so early on. You're just so excited about being in the studio. But then, by the time like being the public on, it was like Mike kind of writing these songs, and then us being in the studio working on the song, you know, or maybe learning it a few days before, and then just kind of working it out in the studio.
Yeah, I guess pretty early on, you guys had a pretty large volume of songs that even if you're playing, like, you know, when you would do, you're playing a whole bunch of shows in one area, you have enough songs you can, like, not just play the same set list every day.
Yeah, but so it's really weird. Like, you feel like, you know, kind of, I feel like always a year in to a record, I'm like, okay, now I know this song. Now I feel comfortable with this song. Like, I wish we'd been playing this song out live before I recorded it so I could have figured out where I wanted the vocals to go and like how I wanted it to sound, as opposed to like frantically trying to figure it out the day of.
Yeah, I mean, I've done both, and if given my choice, I'd much rather road test a song.
Yeah,
like because it makes the recording for everyone like so much easier. If you've already like played a song live a bunch, you can blast through everything on like the first take, and then you're done.
Yeah.
No, like to once again reference something that was in the Vic Bondi podcast, like the idea of like what's the longest you ever you guys had some long records, so by default you should have long sessions, but like what's the longest you guys have ever like recorded like for one record for?
Well, like we've been recording for this thing that we just kind of finished for about 2 years.
Like that's, but how actively?
Like Mike in spurts, like very actively. Like Mike has been in the studio now for about 6 months, just kind of working on it. Like that's not every day going in, like you know. But I'm sure he's actually probably thinking about this stuff every day when he's not in the studio. And then they go in the studio and they'll work for you know, kind of like a week straight on stuff. So yeah, it's. You know, this has been a very different kind of recording process, though, in that regard. Like, normally they're... But mind you, like, Jonah and Mike last time, like, I think as soon as we kind of had the money to kind of, like, spend a little time in the studio, they loved it. But before that, like, when we first were going to the studio, we'd try and record, like, I don't know, like, 20 songs in 48 hours, or, like, 10 songs in 48 hours or whatever. So, I don't know. Yeah, like it's, I guess the longest we've been in one stretch is, I don't know, it's hard to say because Mike and Joan have been there for a long time. Like, longest I've ever done it for one stretch has been like a week straight of going to the studio like every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a job.
I think that would be, like, I remember other, like, when I feel like Ensign would do that as far as like bands that I knew that were like getting in the, like, were they on Nitro, I think? Yeah.
The Pro Corps.
I feel like when they did the second LP, which I believe was on Nitro.
Yeah, it was.
I feel like they were like going in and like Tim talked about like doing like essentially like a song and then going home. And like just like being able to do all your vocals that way, I think it seems like it'd be a waste of time, but if there's no like option, like if there's nothing to hold you back from doing that, then like why wouldn't you, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's definitely way more comfortable. You know, I'll normally do at this point, you know, and I'm not going in the studio all day. If I went in the studio like all day, like, cause normally I have to go home and pick up the kids and stuff like that, but I could probably do like three songs a day. But then, like, you know, you're doing these songs, like, so many times, you know, or, like, not so many times, but you're doing these songs a few times, and you're also doing them, like, just to get the tone right for every song or the levels right and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I could do 3 songs a day, but then I'd be, like, my voice would be shot by the end of the day. So now I do two.
And that's the thing when you think about, like, some of these old hardcore records, that they were like live in the studio, like one track, and just like doing them, you know, all in a go. It's like, it's, you know, you wonder, like, did those bands just like, did they just practice relentlessly so that they could do a clean recording that's the vocals are, you can hear them the whole way through for the most part? Like, obviously, like in BNC or whatever, that Urban Waste song, like, he starts to come in one thing early, or you know, like, you hear that
Prime,
like,
has got the fuck up on it too.
Yeah, like, you'll hear songs where they do that, or like there's like a cough, or like a laugh, you know. But like,
or I was it Jesse Stanhart? No, Pat Fastbreak used to talk all through the backups or something.
I don't know. there's definitely a cough. In the last song on the Pissed LP, there's a cough in a Casualties record. Like, there's some just straight noise that you're like, why wouldn't you just fix that?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what, there's a song, it's on the Mass Control LP, where it really sounds like the drummer drops a stick. If he didn't, it's a stupid fill. And it's just like, why wouldn't you just fix that? Like, you don't have to, you can just start over, man.
It's not punk.
You know, it's not. But yeah, I mean,
when we first started, like, we would do like 4 7-inches, or like, in like a course of a weekend at a studio, like, you know, like, or like, and then a bunch of comp tracks, and then like a bunch of demo songs. Like, I remember the session just before we did Hidden World, we must have recorded like 20 songs in that weekend. But like, I don't know what it is. Like, I guess, like, you know, it wasn't like there didn't feel as much pressure maybe to try and get it right. Like, now when you get older, you probably have, like, you have different expectations. You know, like, I'm sure,
think,
like,
though, it's the life of your band too, though, right? Like, when you guys were starting, your expectations for the group were not the same as, like, you know, when you started to now. So that, I think that's part of it too. You feel either maybe like you have to exceed what you did before, or, you know, you're at a different, I don't know, skill level in some regards.
But Mike might have been one of those guys, like your Greg Ginn's, where, like, he might have had the next 6 records, like, in his head kind of planned out.
He definitely did at one point, you know. Like, I remember, like, you know, around Hidden World, we had, like, you know, that was, like, the period where everything was, like, laid out. And then, you know, we decided, you know, J-Tree came to us and, like, hey, we'll pay you guys to do a record. And we're like, oh, well, maybe we can do things differently. You know, it really changed things when we were all of a sudden presented with the option of being like, yeah, but you could be a pro-core band. And we were like, oh, yeah. Well, wait, not having to have a job? Like, this would be a fun, like, thing to see where it goes for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I toyed with it. It just, you know, it didn't happen.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where, you know, now I realize that's like where you're kind of like building a career, you know, like that's where you're kind of like figuring out what you're going to do with your whole life. And, you know, you get to exist in this like fantasy world for that time period by being in a band, but it's not really like that's going to be the rest of your life. Like, it's not really able to be the rest of your life. Like, unless you're like huge, 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 you know, it's not going to be the rest of your life. Or unless you're extremely talented and able to like pivot into other worlds of music, it's not going to be the rest of your life. It's going to be this like chunk of time, and then it's going to be over, and then you got to kind of start your life.
Well, I mean, I feel like, yeah, I mean, it depends on what the band is, but I feel like some of those bands, like, if you just never break up, you can kind of work that world. If you like, obviously you couldn't live like a baller, but if you live cheap, you could probably, you know, do that. But then again, someone told me a story the other day, and like their Uber driver was like Kevin Seconds. So, like, you know, who's to say that, you know, you can, you know, stick around, not necessarily really go away ever, and still, like, you know, not live off it forever.
Well, the only way Kevin Seconds is making money is on tour, you know, and he's got a family. He wants to probably be home, you know, like you got to do something to pay the bills when you're doing that. And it's like, yeah, it's amazing how like, you know, how much you'd have to sell to be able to like, just kind of like ride and coast, or how popular your band would have to be, you know. In Canada, there's like there's an added cushion because there's government funding, but you know, without that, like, I don't even know how, you know, like how a lot of these, you know, perennial kind of art musicians would survive, like in this kind of like world right now in music. So, you know, not that the grant system in Canada is kind of fucked up. So there's definitely major issues with who gets money and who doesn't get money.
Agreed.
But it's nuts right now to think like how many bands are out there and how many people are trying to make their money through music. You know,
it's to go to a big Damien point. Does Drake get money from Canada, or is he like doesn't need it because he's like too big?
I don't know. Like, to be honest with you, like, I'm sure there's certainly like
at a certain point where can they just like the Parliament or whatever runs Canada just be like, hey, like Avril Lavigne, like you're cool, like you got this, you know, like Drake, you're doing fine, you don't, we Celine Dion, we don't need to pay you, Rush, you guys are fine.
But there's soft money too that comes in, right? And there's like promotional things, like if they have a Canadian label, like their promotion budget will be covered a little bit, you know? And it's, I don't know how much of any money Drake gets from the government at this point, because yeah, he's pretty big. There's actually an article in the Toronto Star about how he actually brings like something like $6 billion worth of commerce to the city of Toronto. Or something, like it's like, yeah. Maybe not $6 billion, but it's something like $3 billion or something. Something in the billions.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder. Like, I can see, like, the idea of the government's trying to like subsidize the arts so that the arts continue.
Yeah,
is great. You know, like, I'm not going to get into like how the money is divided or any of that stuff. Like, I think that's a good use of government money. But like, yeah, I wonder about, you know, if you're at a certain point, does it stop? You know, like, are Loverboy still like getting a check because they were a Canadian rock band at one point?
If Loverboy put out a new record, I'm sure they could figure out a way to qualify to get that record funded by Factor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny that this kind of has hit on this topic, because I was having this discussion yesterday actually about this very thing, because
Loverboy?
I don't know about funding. No, not Loverboy. But about like the idea of like large or like just mega, mega hit artists that have come from Canada still being able to access funds that are, you know, should be for, you know, people who obviously don't have money or what have you. And one of the, I think that's still a gray area. I don't know. I'm feeling like they sadly might still be able to, but my greater concern even than that is, that's a kind of a blatant obvious one, is that they're still recognized, at least using like Drake as an example. I think Drake was shortlisted, if I'm not mistaken, for the Polaris this year.
Yeah.
Which is, to Dave it up, it's like a, you know, it's like a smaller, intended to be, you know, dare I say, like an arts or more like avant-garde.
He's been on it a few times over the years.
Yeah, but and like to a degree it made sense maybe at a time. But like Fucked Up has won this, which in and of itself was, you know, quote-unquote controversial when it happened. But to acknowledge someone like him on it now is, to me, you know, completely pointless, because he gets acknowledgement everywhere else. Like, there's no point for him to be acknowledged on that list, because it's meant for, you know, sort of more distinctly unheard of or like, you know, not hugely commercial acts or what have you.
No,
even though it's, like it's, Arcade Fire's won it, and you know, those acts are big. But
did Fucked Up win it?
Yeah. We won in 2008, I think.
But
2009, but it was, I think it was our record from 2008 that won it. It was like
the chemistry you won.
Yeah, it was the 2008 Polaris Prize, I think. But that award's like their whole mandate is it's an award judged for the best Canadian record solely on artistic merit that came out that year. So, you know, like I definitely don't think Drake needs that money, but at that same time, like Drake being nominated for it, actually, you know, that makes artists like Lido, when she beats Drake, look important, you know? Like, if Drake wasn't on that list, it would make that award look like they're running away from Drake at this point. Whereas, you know, like, him being on that list and Lido winning, like, now Lido's a star, you know? And she's awesome. And, like, you know, the fact that people know about her now and are talking about her is kind of, like, not because of Drake, obviously, but because of, like, you know, people that wouldn't have paid attention to her now know about her because of this award, but that award has legitimacy because it does beat people like Drake, or because Drake's on that list, or The Weeknd's on that list.
Well, something. Drake's never won it, right? He's just been noted.
Yeah, he didn't win. He's never won it. And maybe the last Drake record wasn't the record for him to be nominated for, because it was like a record that, you know, a lot of people didn't like necessarily in the critical sphere. But at the same time, like, that was like one of the biggest records of all time.
Yeah.
So I'm on Wikipedia, and it looks like so Fucked Ups has won it and been shortlisted.
Yeah, we were shortlisted for David and one for Chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the point being, I guess my
in your I face, Elliot Brood.
Yeah.
I can't argue entirely what you're saying. It's like, I get that too, but I still just think, for me, it just seems like, well, as all award kind of things are anyway, like these weird empty gesture things that are largely irrelevant. But I worry about how much, you know, by and large, the fairly problematic, in a certain regard, Canadian music industry behaves, and how much it wants to rub the shoulders of, you know, these large, giant commercial artists to keep saying to the world, like, you know, we're really relevant, guys. Look, right? When the people here already, you know, the people who, like, follow the acts that are nominated that aren't giant commercial successes are already aware of that. So I get that you're playing the game and that's what they're doing, but it's, I don't know, that's more my qualm with it, is that, you know, yes, I don't want gigantic mega millionaires getting any money that they don't and need anyway. I don't care who they are. And then secondly, it's like, I don't really... personally, I don't buy that acknowledgement being even not only warranted but necessary, even if someone else just beats them and then it looks better. But it's all subjective, because, you know, I also don't happen to like the artists that we're talking about, so that's another whole ball of wax. But
the critical sphere is dead, you know, like, biggest is best now. Like, we had the critical sphere was at its height, you know, a couple years ago when Pitchfork kind of reigned supreme, and they were like a kingmaker, and a good review on Pitchfork meant your band was important. It didn't matter that your band was not that big, you know, and I play in one of the bands that benefited from that 100%. I have to acknowledge that, but now that's kind of like gone, you know, like, you know, I was looking today at a major music site and looking at like one of their editors try and drop knowledge on a subject. And it was just like, it was nuts. And, you know, and I was like, wow, like, I should tweet this person and kind of call them out on how kind of ill-informed this opinion that they have is. And then I was like, wait, why would I do that? Like, it's almost like, yeah, like, we don't live in a point, there's no point in doing that anymore. You know, like, it's just like, just let this person have their ridiculous opinion. Like, biggest is best, you know, like, that's, you know, and then, but maybe that's true. Like, you know, I'm sitting in a room surrounded by overpriced records that, you know, were in micro pressings. So, you know, maybe I'm the fool.
Well, I mean, that goes against it, because those bands, you know, were not the biggest.
No, I know, exactly. Know? But like, you know, maybe we're wrong. You know, maybe the best stuff is the most popular stuff. Like maybe like maybe, you know, maybe I don't know. I'm about to like name off some genres and I'm like, No, I can't. Like I'm not gonna be that person because like, you know, like the genre that I would name off like are just as valid as Burning Spirits hardcore or you know, like you know, Scandinavian D beat influenced, you know, crust stuff, you know, like or just like whatever kind of micro genre that we're like find way more exciting than what's happening on the major level, even in punk, you know, like the stuff that we're interested in is like, even like the most obscure stuff in punk. It just happens that like most of the cool people that came out of punk, we're all into the same sort of stuff. In my opinion,
yeah.
Most of the coolest people. Yeah. And that's hopefully bore out by this podcast over time, you know?
No. Yeah, I mean, it'll be the biggest, and it'll be the best, and it'll be the coolest.
Yeah, but I mean, like, no, but I mean, like, the biggest is the best now. Like, so unfortunately, you know, we don't really, you know, like, you can't, like, it's just like weird to kind of like have to accept the fact that like, oh, there's like the coolest is the most popular at this point.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know, Obviously, I don't agree with that, really, but I know what you're getting at with saying it. Like, that's what seems to win out as far as, like, exposure or something. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's what makes that taste, because that's the way the machine works. The mechanism is driven by that kind of attention now. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's the only unfortunate part about, you know, sort of the greatness of like, you know, simultaneously where I can look up every nuanced factoid of whatever the hell I want to know. At the same time, it's the bombardment of everything else is just, you know, largely what group, like whatever kind of like mass, you know, audience appeal, you know, is being pushed at the same time that sort of often is like, it's hard to get or even around to get to the cool things, mm-hmm. in my opinion. So yeah, I know what you mean. I don't feel that way, and I think this show dictates that that's not the way a lot of people feel. But yeah, it's hard to awards are irrelevant in the sense that that stuff clearly wins out because that's what you're being bombarded with on a regular, you know, hourly, minutely basis.
Yeah, like look at the Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions this year, and people are like, you know, like I think that speaks to it. Like that's the stuff that's, you know, that unfortunately is the most mainstream, middle of the road stuff, and that's the stuff that's going to get acknowledged.
We did a whole thing on that a year ago, and so I laughed when I saw that. I saw a headline about it, and it was something to do with like basically them saying they botched it again and didn't induct whoever. I didn't even look at the list this year because I just thought last year's was so absurd. I'm not even going to bother. Mm-hmm. But. So it's funny you bring it up. But yeah, that one's an especially, because that one's even super subjective too, because it just doesn't make any sense, legitimate. It doesn't make any sense, period.
Like, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees are super wacky always.
Yeah, it's like, it might as well be like you know, like a lottery draw, legitimately. Like, it's so bizarre.
Because there's all the, like the, pet, like, what's the word I want to say, but like, like the old guard that they just have to like give a nod to, you know. Yeah. It's like when Jethro Tull won like the Grammy for heavy metal records, you know, like,
yeah,
there's these ones you just have to include.
You know what, in wrestling, you know, it always comes back to wrestling for me, there's the WWE Hall of Fame, right? And that's, yeah, everyone just like is like, oh god, like it, and it's very similar to what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame would be, you know. But then there's, you know, the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, you know, that Dave Meltzer organizes with his from Wrestling Observer, one of the longest running wrestling news sites. Dave Meltzer is one of the most respected wrestling journalists, one of very respected sports journalists, I'd actually say. But anyway, so he has
not just journalists all around.
I you know what? Journalists all around. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, so they have their Observer Hall of Fame, and it's very respected because they take it seriously. I think we should do a Turned Out of Punk Hall of Fame. And like we voted in people. I like that. You know, fans, listeners, friends, we all vote in people, and then we can kind of like, you know, do it like a ballot, like set it up like a real Hall of Fame and keep track of it. And then
will it be more or less successful than the compilation list?
The compilation list is still going, I think, Chris, right?
Well, the best comps of all time. Eventually, but
this
could
be better because this involves everyone voting, and then we'll have like a list. Like we'll come up with this list, and then we got to write like, you know, why these people should be in it. You know, and we'll have an inaugural class, right? Where we'll put in like, you know, it'll be the Mount Rushmore, and we can have, you know, we'll have to confront some truths about some bands. You know,
but what are you okay? So you need to set some guidelines here. So you're saying punk centric stuff, or just in like what's the criteria here?
We're gonna start a punk centric, but then we'll grow it out. Like turn out a punk the podcast. Like, you know, as long as it can be connected to it, it can be part of it. And believe me, there's something coming up tomorrow where after this, you can connect Brand Nubian to the Cro-Mags.
Okay, but yeah, this is what I mean. Like, I guess my immediate concern upon this loose definition is I do not want any semblance of homies being a song or anything like that.
That will not happen, Chris. Because like if you listen to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, they have lists from like Japan, right? And they have lists from like England, right? And then they have lists like, so we're going to have to do, it's like there'll be like a South American list, right? There'll be an Eastern European list. There'll be a Western European list. There'll be maybe just have to be a UK list too, you know?
But are we doing bands? Are we doing artists? Are we doing albums?
We're doing bands. They have to go in as a band.
Okay.
You know, and you go in and you're like that way you have to look at the whole piece. You have to look at the whole catalog, right? So I'd argue like Wretched, who are kind of good the whole way through, are going to have a good chance of getting in there. Leatherface, good the whole way through, you know?
I just like that the first name upon this criteria was you pulled up Wretched.
I was just looking at the Wretched name. LP from like the late 80s right now in my record stack.
Latua or whatever?
Yeah, and I'm like, that record's pretty fucking sick. So I'm like, they're pretty...
Yeah, it's not...
You know,
I'm just laughing that of all the names of all the this is the greatest of
Gauze.
Lists.
Gauze.
So obviously, you start with Wretched, then you work your way down.
Yeah, exactly. You know, obviously, Wretched's the first band in. No, but maybe Wretched's a poor example. But I kind of but Gauze is definitely, I would say,
yes.
You know, first ballot.
I think Wretched, though, is a perfect footnotes example. So good job there. I was thinking more personally when you were bringing this up, this idea. I thought, okay, well, what would be the first round? Like, I was thinking of those kind of seminal acts. So,
but,
yeah. Like,
but then it also becomes a matter of, like, do you pick things where you're like, oh, I'll just say the Abused because they only legitimately put out, like, a record. So then there's
I think the Abused are one of my favorite New York hardcore bands ever, and I would say one of the best 7-inches of all time. Are they a Hall of Fame act? Probably not. You know,
this is the debate. That's a
tough one. I would say like Crucifix, because Crucifix have a 12-inch, a 7-inch, and an LP, all killer. So they have
Crucifix
multiple releases.
And Live, they were really good. I would say though, like here's the things you talk about when you talk about if it's a Hall of Fame artist, right? Like, you kind of have to look at long-term effects on culture, you know? And I would say that Crucifix is an artist that eventually would wind up in a Hall of Fame, you know, from my standpoint, definitely, because I think those records are unreal, killer. But at the same time, like, no. Do I think they go in the first round? No.
So the first round considerations are the deepest impact and penetration on culture from the whatever the...
Yeah, well, I would say culture. I would say punk. You know, like a band that like changed everything. You know, like an artist who you could argue like shifted the cultural fabric.
Well, if you want a band that put a stamp on culture, Crucifix, the one dude, then went on to do lip service, yep. which made clothes for all the cock rock bands. Yep.
No, he definitely.
So they really did put a mark on culture.
I would say
to bring it back around.
I think they definitely could. We'll wind up in the Hall of Fame, Dave. But I don't think like would I put them in over, Gauze? No. You know, would I put them in over even like a Los Crudos? Because I think Los Crudos, you know, definitely could be argued shifted the culture, had major impact. You know, like
I would say
they go in over Crucifix sooner than Crucifix. Like not that I think that I like, you know, anything more than certain Crucifix songs in music, but I think that's once again like that's personal taste, and we're talking about what winds up in a Hall of Fame.
Gotcha. Yeah,
the Kids.
That's well stated. I agree.
You know, the Kids from Belgium. I think they would be one that you could argue, right? Like, you know, you'd have to probably
put... Yeah, but would the Kids from Belgium get in before, like, Radio Birdman?
I don't know. That's interesting. That would be one that you'd have to kind of talk about, because I think for my personal taste, like, I like Radio Birdman more, but I think Kids from Belgium, you know, that definitely, having been in that country... Like, I judge a lot of these things, like, when you talk to a random person from one of these places... And, you know, and you just bring up this band, what kind of reactions you get, you know, Radio Birdman is, you know what? I think Radio Birdman would have to be one of the first ones you go in. Cause like you go to Australia, they are the remote.
You're cutting. I think going forward, once you have like your base, then you could have like the 2018 nominees are.
No, but sorry. What I mean is like you said, Hulk Hogan, like that wrestling one. Is there like Hulk Hogan was first, and that's like that's a thing?
Have like an inaugural. I don't think you'd have to decide who would be the first one, but I think you'd have like an inaugural class, right? Like that you'd be like,
yeah, okay,
we're gonna put all these people in, so we don't have to like waste, the first few years doing that, right? And so that's also a lot of debate, like who would go in that first class.
I think Dave named off a bunch. I would say. Yeah. See, the other question about this is where the worry comes in for me too with mm-hmm. this list, although, you know, it's still interesting regardless, is like, where do the Green Days go? Do they go? Where does the Offspring go? Do they go?
Well, because we're talking about those things. You know, like there's definitely other criteria, right? Like, you know, like, do you think that they, you know, had a positive effect on the culture, right? Like, you know, or did they maybe not necessarily have a positive effect? I think Green Day, it could be argued, did have very... positive effect, and same with the Offspring, because it attracted like a whole new wave of kids to get into it. So like I think you kind of do have to put them in, but I'm sure some people could make an argument like they should they go in before a band like Fugazi or Bikini Kill. Like, you know, that's an argument that, you know, I think someone could make.
Yeah, I get what you're, yeah, this is my worry is just that I wouldn't want it just on the criteria of like affecting culture or whatever the criteria of that was. Because then you could throw in a whole bunch of just, you know, bands like that. And it's not that there's necessarily anything wrong with these bands inherently, but I'm less interested in that personally than I am whatever, the Wretcheds or the, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, like I don't think they would go in. I wouldn't put Green Day in that first class. Like I would put them in pretty soon, but I think like every year you could probably have like... You know, like, because you're doing it by country, you know, or by region, I should say, you know, like, you'd have a whole Scandinavian wing, you know, like, you'd be putting in
artists. So you're saying each geographical region gets their first waves, is what you're saying. So
well, I think each, there's, like, some way of weighting it. I got to look better, more into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, how they do it. But they definitely
you've got to help these, us
like, with this. They definitely have geographical breakdowns. You know,
okay,
to help navigate people getting in, I think, because like there's a lot of debate about, you know, different areas and, you know, but you could have like you'd have to put a list up every year, right? Like, so, and then you could have people like you could put people into the list and then people get voted off the list. If they're not voted in after a certain number of years, they're off that list.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then they have to be nominated to get back on that list somehow.
See, I like this idea. I just think, wow, that's pretty. Didn't expect that.
No, it's definitely. Yeah. It's like a real Hall of Fame ballot.
But how would you know? Like, for someone to even get nominated enough and not get in, then get voted. Like, I just, yeah, that. Well, because it's all the same.
Like, that's why you make that criteria super stiff, right? Like, the people that are getting in here, it's like, you know, it's not like, you know, just any Italian hardcore band is wretched.
But would they go in before Raw Power?
No way they go in before Raw Power. Raw Power 100% exactly. Goes in before Wretched. Like, you know, and it's because, like, Raw Power, like, you know, it's they were the band, like Freddie Alva's episode, you know, like he talks about they were like one of the first hardcore bands he ever saw and how much they blew his mind, you know, like they were trading tapes with people all over the world. They were like really the ambassadors of that scene and that sound, like, internationally. And, like, you know, certainly Wretched and Jesty, I think, will eventually make it into a Hall of Fame of this kind of type that we're describing. But, like, I think Raw Power has to go in first.
So yeah. I have another little bit of brainstorming to throw into this, mm-hmm. using one group as an example. So the idea of groups being nominated and perhaps what could work against a group, let's say. Take a group like Corrosion of Conformity, right? Uh-huh. And spanning the entirety of the career, does the latter life of a group perhaps counteract to the point where it would be difficult for one of those groups to get in using, say, like a COC or a... trying to think of another example like that. Anyway, do you get where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, but the thing with COC is they, besides the fact that Eye for an Eye is one of my favorite records,
yeah.
With the Animosity, them and DRI help, like, change the landscape, which yes. I think should give them credit for doing that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep, I think you make that. I think that definitely now, especially looking at it from 2017 eyes. You know, 100%. You make that argument, too. But do they go in? You know, they'd have to go in after, like, Black Flag, right?
Oh yeah,
and DOA. Yeah. If we're doing it by geographical region,
I think the first wave, I think, is just shoo-ins. I think they're easy. Like, I think it's just every, you know, take whatever kind of, like, book, like, even like what All Music would, like, if all music had a what is. Hardcore.
Yeah, but that's why we can't. But that's, you have to, like, have, like, the big boys. You know, you'd have to have. You know, there's, like, other artists that. Oh, guys, unfortunately, I think I might have to call this the end tonight. If you guys can continue, because it looks like Dorian is up.
Does he want to really throw in his two cents?
Yeah.
He's like, wait, are you guys going to just talk about CUC but not bring up Bloodmobile?
He hasn't had a chance to think about his picks.
He's like, you know, the CUC people are definitely going to vote with a bullet. So, you know, you got to be careful with that as well. Hey,
you know.
All
right.
Oh, gosh. I can do this all day.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what you guys have planned for the rest of the weekend, but...